Welcome back to our podcast on anesthesia basics. If you joined us for episode one, you now have a basic understanding of what anesthesia is, how it works, and what happens before and during surgery. But today, we're tackling something a little bit different, the risks and complications of anesthesia. Now, if we're honest, this is the part that makes people the most nervous. A lot of patients worry about anesthesia. They worry about if they don't wake up, if they wake up too soon, and the possible long-term damages they may experience. In this episode, we're going to break down the actual risks of anesthesia, how rare or common they really are, what happens when things go wrong, and how the anesthesia teams handle those emergencies. We'll also cover how anesthesia is evolving with new technology and research that are making it safer than ever. By the end of the episode, you'll have a clear, evidence-based understanding of anesthesia risks and hopefully some peace of mind. So let's start off with the big question. How risky is anesthesia really? A lot of people think that going under anesthesia is extremely dangerous, but the reality is very different. Modern anesthesia is one of the safest medical practices, thanks to years of research, precise drug dosing, and continuous monitoring. Here are the actual numbers. Risk of death directly due to anesthesia in a healthy patient is 1 in 200,000. In a healthy patient, remember how we defined in the last episode, is usually someone in ASA class 1 or class 2. Serious complications, so things like having awareness during the operation or experiencing a severe allergic reaction, is about 1 to 10,000 or 1 in 20,000. Minor side effects, on the other hand, nausea, sore throat, and confusion is more common, and this is usually experienced by patients in a rate of 1 in 3 patients. So, what factors affect anesthesia risk? Not every patient has the same level of risk. Some factors that increase anesthesia risk include the patient's age, if the patient is of healthy BMI or is considered obese. In terms of age, very young patients and elderly patients can be prone to metabolize anesthesia differently, and patients with obesity have an increased risk of airway obstruction and possibility of respiratory issues that you might encounter. Other factors include smoking. Individuals who smoke have a higher likelihood of developing post-operative lung complications. Other than that, we also have heart or lung disease. Those patients with these diseases may need closer monitoring during and post-op. And other factor that may increase anesthesia risk is emergency surgery. The reason behind that is that there's less time to optimize the patient's condition prior to administering the anesthesia, which can make the operating room factors a little bit more unpredictable. But to talk about our ASA patients once again and the risks, we can conclude that ASA 1 in 2 patients, their risk of anesthesia-related complications is extremely low, and ASA 3 and higher require more careful planning and much more monitoring. So let's dive more into the common side effects of anesthesia. So the most common side effects. So while the severe complications might be rare, mild side effects are much more common. And I'm going to list out some of the most frequently reported post-anesthesia, side effects. First one, probably the most common, even in my observation, is postoperative nausea and vomiting, abbreviated PONV. This affects about 30 to 50% of patients, but is usually treated with medications intraoperatively, like Zofran, which is the brand name, and ondansetron, which is the generic name. Risk factors for patients to experience PONV is if they have a history of motion sickness, if they are of the female gender, and if they have non-smoker status. Second most common side effect is sore throat and hoarseness. This is a bit unavoidable as it's usually caused by the irritation from the endotracheal intubation, or an LMA if that's what we've decided to use. Either way, both the sore throat and the hoarseness usually resolve within 24 to 48 hours post-extubation. Patients may also experience shivering or chills, which can also be termed as post-operative hypothermia. Some of the anesthetics used during a procedure can cause a temporary drop in body temperature. And the treatment for that is usually warming blankets or heated IV fluids, which can help to treat or even prevent this. Last most common anesthesia side effect is delayed recovery or grogginess. Some patients, more particularly elderly patients, may take longer to metabolize the anesthetic drugs. Factors like pre-existing cognitive impairment, long surgeries, and high anesthetic doses tend to contribute and increase the likelihood of this side effect. Now, with more severe and but rare anesthesia complications, while most complications tend to be, or more side effects tend to be mild, there are some serious but rare complications that require immediate intervention. These are the never miss complications. If a patient is experiencing respiratory depression, this can be caused by too much sedation, and the patient would present with decreased breathing rates, so slow breathing. They may be requiring increased oxygen support or increased assistance in ventilation. Something else is a patient may experience severe hypotension. This is also more common in elderly patients than or those who are on hypertensive medications or blood pressure medications. This is usually treated with IV fluids and vasopressors. Examples of vasopressors that might be used include, but are not limited to, phenylephrine and ephedrine. And probably one of the scariest things that can happen to a patient as a anesthesia complication is anaphylaxis, which is a severe allergic reaction to the drugs that we're using. Although extremely rare, it's very much so life-threatening, requires immediate epinephrine, steroids, and the use of IV fluids. Next, let's take a look at a case study exploring the management of a high-risk anesthesia patient. So we have a 67-year-old male with a history of severe COPD and heart disease, and he's scheduled for an abdominal surgery. His ASA classification is 4, which is a high-risk category. He's prone to low oxygen saturation due to his lung disease, and due to his heart disease, takes beta blockers. And this may cause an additional risk of intraoperative hypotension. So the anesthesia team strategy for this particular patient is regional anesthesia being used instead of general anesthesia. This decision was made to reduce lung complications There was a very careful fluid and blood pressure management during the case to avoid hypotension. And the patient was kept on supplemental oxygen and recovery to prevent postoperative hypoxia. Case outcome is that the surgery was able to be completed safely with no major complications. And this case is a great example of how anesthesia isn't just about putting someone to sleep, it's tailoring the anesthetic plan to the individual needs. This patient has the lung disease, the heart disease, and is having abdominal surgery. First, we did the risk stratification. Then we thought about the things that might go wrong during the surgery and formulated a plan, an anesthetic plan for their surgery in order to maintain high quality care and admit and have real good patient safety. So to wrap up this segment, what have we learned? We learned that modern anesthesia is much safer than we might think. It's incredibly safe, especially for healthy patients who classify in the lower ASA classifications. There are some mild side effects to consider, like postoperative nausea or delayed emergence and grogginess. Those things may be common, but the more complicated, rare things, they're a little bit less likely to occur. Anesthesia risks varies based on the patient's medical conditions, but anesthesiologists carefully assess the patients and do their best to minimize those risks. And the use of advanced monitoring and tailoring those anesthesia plans to the patients definitely help ensure patient safety. In our next segment, we'll look at what happens when things go wrong and how the anesthesia team manages complications in real time. So now that we understand the risks of anesthesia, let's talk about what happens when something goes wrong. While severe complications are rare, like we mentioned in the previous segment, anesthesia teams are trained to respond within seconds, and this is to prevent serious harm. Anesthesia is never set it and forget it. It's an active process that requires constant monitoring, real-time decision-making, and rapid interventions when necessary. In this segment, we'll cover the most common intraoperative anesthesia complications, how anesthesia teams recognize and manage those emergencies, and go over a case study showing those responses in action. One of the scariest anesthesia fears is intraoperative awareness, but it's very rare. It occurs in 1 to 2 per 1,000 surgeries, and most cases that have happened are documented in trauma surgery, cardiac surgery, or C-sections where lower doses of anesthesia may be used to protect the vital organs. Patients who experience these may say they experience sensations or pressure sounds, but full awareness with pain is even more rare. In episode one, we spoke about ABIS, this bispectral index monitor. In conjunction with this, EEG tracking can also be used to help reduce the risk of intraoperative awareness. In one case study, a patient undergoing emergency trauma surgery under lighter doses of anesthesia due to blood pressure concerns reported hearing voices, but no pain. Additional sedation was quickly administered upon noticing the EEG changes in order to make sure that the patient was safe. Speaking of other things that can go wrong, the one that we're most commonly exposed to in our preclinical studies is malignant hyperthermia. Malignant hyperthermia is a rare genetic reaction to certain anesthetic drugs. Things like succinylcholine, for example. This can be identified by uncontrolled muscle contractions. The patient may feel rigid, essentially. There may be a dangerously high fever. Patient temperatures can exceed 105 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 degrees Celsius. And with that comes severe metabolic and cardiovascular instability. So you might be asking, how do we manage a condition like this, like malignant hyperthermia? It's managed with the immediate administration of dantrolene. Dantrolene is a sort of muscle relaxant that kind of reverses what's going on. In hospitals, particularly near ORs, it's very common to find a malignant hyperthermia kit that has everything you need to treat malignant hyperthermia if it occurs. Other than dantrolene, other measures include cooling the patient, administering IV fluids, and intensive monitoring is needed immediately. Patients are screened for family history of malignant hyperthermia preoperatively. That's when we ask them, have they ever had a bad reaction to anesthesia? Do they have any family members who've ever had bad reactions to anesthesia? One more common battle of things that go wrong intraoperatively can be something like severe hypotension or hemodynamic instability. This is something that anesthesiologists are always thinking about, always ready for. Some patients may experience dangerously low blood pressure when under anesthesia. This causes reduced blood flow to organs and carries a risk of stroke or myocardial infarction, more particularly in those ASA 3 plus patients. So, what does the anesthesia team do then? There's a lot of monitoring that occurs, as we've spoken about in the previous episode. So, there's continuous arterial blood pressure monitoring that will give them real-time readings. This is considered like an A-line, for example. Anesthesiologists can also administer vasopressors like phenylephrine or norepinephrine if they feel that the patient's blood pressure needs to be stabilized. And we can also adjust the depth of anesthesia if needed. Patients experiencing lower blood pressure may need lighter sedation, and sometimes we'll ease off the gases in order to help bring up the blood pressure. In this case study, we will explore a 74-year-old patient with a history of heart disease who experienced a sudden drop of blood pressure to 70 over 40 during an orthopedic surgery. He was having a hip replacement. Things that the anesthesia team did immediately upon receiving that blood pressure reading, it was to open fluids and administering his fluids wide open. We also gave ephedrine to raise the blood pressure and adjusted the inhaled anesthetic doses to reduce circulatory depression. End result and outcome, the patient was stabilized and the surgery was able to be proceeded safely. There's three more complications that I want to talk about in this episode. First of the three is postoperative delirium and cognitive dysfunction. This is more niche to the elderly patient population. They are more prone to experience confusion, memory loss, or even personality changes after anesthesia. There are some things that work to increase the likelihood of postoperative delirium and cognitive dysfunction, though. Things like a very long, prolonged surgery. That may induce a post-op delirium, for example. Patients who have some kind of pre-existing dementia also is considered a risk factor, and having higher anesthetic doses can also contribute. Most cases usually resolve within a few days to a few weeks, but can last longer, but it's extremely rare for that to happen. Some strategies that we can use to reduce the risk is using shorter acting anesthetics, things like propofol instead of benzodiazepines. We can optimize the patient preoperatively with hydration and making sure that they're well oxygenated. And we can also avoid prolonged deep sedation, particularly when it's not necessary. Second of the three more that I wanted to talk about are anaphylaxis and severe drug reactions. And we spoke a little bit about anaphylaxis a little bit earlier, so we're going to focus more on the severe drug reactions. If the patient's having reactions to something like antibiotics that are given during surgery, usually when an anesthesiologist administers antibiotics to patients, it's done in a very technical manner. The antibiotic is administered, the time is noted, and then there's a waiting period. During that waiting period, we're trying to see if the medication is safe for the patient before we continue. It's important to make sure that patients do not undergo anaphylaxis due to antibiotics, and if they do, that we're ready to treat them right away. Patients who do have drug allergies to antibiotics or any other drugs are often wearing some kind of red bracelet or hospital tag that indicates that those patients have severe allergies to those drugs. And they are not only highlighted by the anesthesiologist, they are highlighted during timeout, prior to the surgery. An incision to make sure that the patient remains safe. Lastly, I want to talk about complications in oxygenation and emergencies regarding the airway that may occur. Something called a laryngeal spasm is when there's a sudden closing of the vocal cords, which blocks airflow. You can also have a bronchospasm where there is a constriction of the lower airways. This now is more common in patients who have asthma. And last under this category is difficult intubation. In our previous episode, Dr. Olivier talked about ventilation and it being arguably the most important thing to consider over intubation. If you can't ventilate and you end up with a difficult intubation, you're in trouble. So patients are made sure that we can ventilate them prior to intubation. And if the patient has a difficult anatomy, then there might be other technologies or other maneuvers that we may consider prior to intubation. So there's always a prep, a backup plan, and consideration prior to intubating patients. So for all of these possible complications and risks, how does the anesthesia team respond? Particularly in the airway emergencies, we're looking at bag mask ventilation, emergency airway devices, or a surgical airway may be necessary. We can use muscle relaxants in severe laryngeal spasms, and a lot of times, how we prep for emergencies falls back on how we prepped our patient prior to even rolling them back. So, our preoperative airway assessment to predict and prevent issues. So, that wraps up segment two. So, what did we cover? We learned that anesthesia is not without risks, but most complications are manageable. And although some complications may be rare, we do have ways to manage them as well. We know that modern monitoring technology allows anesthesiologists to detect and respond to these emergencies within seconds. Preoperative screenings and personalized anesthetic plans work to dramatically reduce the rate of all those complications. Even in high-risk situations, anesthesia teams are trained to anticipate, prevent, and resolve problems before they become life-threatening. In our next segment, we'll look at how anesthesia is evolving with new technology, safer drugs, and personalized anesthesia care. In our first episode, we talked about Ether and Ether Day, and we've come a long way since. New advancements in anesthesiology are pushing the field further than ever before. We've talked about risk and complications. Now it's time to look at the future of anesthesia. What's changing? What's improving? And how technology is making it safer and more personalized. In this segment, we'll talk about new anesthesia drugs that are changing the game, how AI and technology are revolutionizing anesthesia monitoring, and the rise of personal anesthesia, tailoring drugs and techniques to each patient's need. AI and artificial intelligence are already transforming many areas of medicine, and anesthesia is no exception. Smart anesthesia workstations can predict patient responses and adjust medication doses in real time. AI-driven algorithms are being tested to detect early signs of complications before they become critical. Some operating rooms are testing automated anesthesia delivery systems, where AI adjusts the drug levels based on patient feedback. These advancements could very well mean safer anesthesia, with fewer human errors and more precise drug administration. New drugs with faster recovery times are now making way into the anesthesia field. One of the biggest challenges in anesthesia is balancing the depth of sedation with fast recovery. Researchers are looking into new anesthetics agents that will allow for faster wake-up times, which will work to reduce grogginess and post-op confusion, lower the risk of side effects like nausea and delirium, and to have better pain control without a heavy reliance on opioids. Some of the promising new drugs include remimazolam. It is a benzodiazepine-like drug that wears off faster than propofol and allows for quicker recovery. Another drug is cleveprex. It is a short-acting blood pressure medication that helps maintain stable circulation during surgery, and also ultra-short-acting opioids, which work to reduce respiratory depression while still controlling the patient's pain. These next-generation drugs will help anesthesia providers give a more tailored care, reducing post-op complications and hospital stays. Next advancement that I wanted to talk about was personalized anesthesia based on genetics. Right now, anesthesia is largely based on the patient's weight, their age, their medical history. But in the future, that pre-op assessment might take into account genetic makeup. Some people will metabolize anesthetics faster or slower, depending on genetic variations. And research into pharmacogenomics is helping us understand why some patients are more sensitive to anesthesia than others. In the future, we can imagine a simple genetic test could help anesthesiologists choose the perfect drug with the perfect dose for each individual patient. This would mean fewer complications, faster recovery, and more predictable anesthesia effects. Lastly, I wanted to speak a little bit about the push for opioid-free anesthesia. With the opioid crisis being still a major issue in the United States, many hospitals and anesthesia providers are looking away. They're looking for ways to reduce opioid use during surgery. Some alternatives to think about include multimodal anesthesia, which includes combining different drug classes like local anesthetics, NSAIDs, or even combinations with regional nerve blocks, all to reduce patient postoperative pain without the use of opioids. The regional anesthesia techniques like spinal or epidural blocks to numb surgical sites would work well without affecting the brain. Additionally, non-opioid IV pain medication like dexmedetomidine, ketamine, and lidocaine infusions are being considered for post-op pain control. By reducing the reliance on opioids, anesthesia providers can help patients recover faster with less risk of dependency or opioid-related side effects. This is the end of segment three. So, what have we learned? We covered AI and automation and how they're making anesthesia safer and more precise. We've talked about new drugs that are leading to faster recovery and fewer side effects. Personalized anesthesia could very well become a reality, working to reduce unpredictable drug responses. We're also talking about the shift towards opioid-free anesthesia and its improvement in post-op pain management. The field of anesthesia is constantly evolving, and in the next decade, we may see even more dramatic changes on how anesthesia is administered, monitored, and how it even becomes more personalized. The future is looking safer and better. Now for our last segment, which includes a Q&A with an expert in the field. We have our guest here back today, Dr. Olivier Mandelier. He's a board-certified anesthesiologist who is an attending at Johns Hopkins University, the Bayview campus. He's here today to answer some questions for us in part two. Our first question today for him are, what are some of the most common intraoperative emergencies that he must be prepared for, and how does he manage them?
Well, thinking about that question, I wouldn't say common emergencies. There are a few things that happen almost every case. I'd say your hypotension from induction of anesthetics or anesthetics overall, and or high hypertension are things that are common in the operating room. The other things that we see, I wouldn't say they're common per se. No, I would say they're rare. But as the anesthesiologist or the anesthesia team, you would want to be able to predict based on your patient preoperative evaluation what to watch out for. Some patients are prone to allergies, so if you were to induce an anesthetic or during the case, you would be ready for an allergic reaction or anaphylaxis. Based on your physical examination, a patient would you would be able to pick up if a patient would be a difficult ventilation or intubation. Same thing with bronchospasm, same thing with blood loss based on the type of procedure that you're doing. So there's a lot that can happen. A lot of it can be labeled rare. And a lot of it can be labeled common. But as an anesthesiologist, one thing for sure that I know that I'm going to be treating is blood pressure, low blood pressure and high blood pressure, and high stimulation and pain. Those are the main things that I'm concerned about, and that happens commonly, and I want to assure adequate perfusion to the organs. Outside of that, everything that happens can be somewhat unexpected, but we're always ready to treat based on your patient evaluation preoperatively.
All right, moving on. What are the key considerations when deciding between using general versus regional anesthesia? Also, how do you determine the best block for a specific procedure?
When evaluating a patient, the type of anesthetic depends mostly on the type of surgery and also the patient medical history. As far as the type of surgery, some cases can be done with mild sedation, moderate or deep sedation. That's one type of anesthetic. Some can be done with regional anesthesia only, with a little bit of sedation. And your regional anesthesia technique can be a surgical block, where you don't need much else to have the case continue. It can be a neuroaxial technique. For example, if you were to do a total joint procedure, especially in knees and hips, you would do a spinal. Or if you were to do laboring patient or a C-section, you would also do a spinal. And then some surgeries can only be done under general anesthesia. You have your bigger procedures like neuro procedures, positioning. The patient can be a challenge that requires general anesthesia because you want to secure the airway. Laparoscopic procedures, these have to be done under general anesthesia. In addition, if the patient does have some comorbidities, cardiopulmonary comorbidities are the most important ones that to keep in mind. If the procedure can be done with regional anesthesia technique or local anesthesia, typically the anesthesia team would decide to avoid general anesthesia for such a patient and try to do it with other methods. So one, patient profile, medical history, and the type of procedure dictates the decision.
Sounds like there's a lot to consider when approaching all of these procedures and decisions. How do you approach hemodynamic management in the OR, particularly in high-risk patients like those with heart or cardiac disease?
In high-risk patients, it's important to evaluate the need of invasive monitors and the need for a tighter hemodynamic parameters. Let's say we have a cardiac patient, kidney patient, diabetic patient, you need to have a way to monitor those values. So the approach is usually one, to tailor your medications to avoid significant swings of in blood pressure and heart rate. Two, also tailor your anesthetics, your maintenance anesthetic for such things. Three is to elect to place extra monitors like an invasive arterial line, maybe a central line if it is expected that the patient may have significant blood loss, volume needs, or a pressure requirements. Those are indications for central line. And depending on the case, there are some other monitors to consider. For example, your neuro cases may require neuro monitoring done by a specific team. You would have to tailor your anesthetic to essentially try to avoid any interference with the anesthetic with the neuro monitor. Some medications you can give or not. But the biggest thing is, once you see a patient, your preoperative evaluation, you start to go down in your mind an algorithm as to, one, does this patient can do well with one agent, the main agent, which is propofol, versus another more cardiac stable agent, typically etomidate. Second, you would ask, does the patient need an arterial line for tighter blood pressure control, and when would you place it? The rule of thumb is, if the patient has significant cardiac concerns, it's wise to place an arterial line prior to induction of anesthesia to have a beat-by-beat measurement of your hemodynamic changes while you're inducing the patient. So that's essentially a more or less the approach. You see the patient, you go down an algorithm to see what the patient needs. Invasive line, invasive monitors, extra monitor for the case, etc., etc.
All right, so the next question I have is, what are the best practices for post-op pain management? And how do you incorporate multimodal analgesia into your practice?
With opioids being a concern, both clinically in the hospital and out in the community, we as a group or in myself try very, very hard to not rely on opioids too much for pain control unless there is zero other way to provide any analgesic. So when I am doing a case, one thing that I do is doing a multimodal approach by providing different analgesic like IV Tylenol, IV Toradol, other anesthetics that have post-op pain or pain profiles like ketamine or dex. Methadonidine, also called Presidex, and those medications are proven to have some effect of analgesia. And as much as possible, I try to incorporate local anesthesia into a case, whether it's encouraging the surgical team to inject as much as local anesthesia as possible into their surgical sites, or by providing regional anesthesia techniques to the patient. So with those things, I try to minimize the amount of opioids as much as possible. But certain cases in some patients, they do still require some touches of opioids. But at least the effort of using a multimodal approach can certainly lower the amount of opioids, the side effects that comes with it, patient recovery, and also the risk of running into an addictive pattern.
Okay, personally, I have some interests in OB anesthesia. I know Dad would be proud. So the next question I have is, what are the biggest challenges in obstetric anesthesia, and how do you manage complications that might happen? So things like failed epidurals, or if a patient is experiencing postdural puncture headaches.
The challenges in OB anesthesia can be numerous. Potentially, that's why I try to tailor my practice. And this is not an encouragement for any medical student or residents to do the same. But for me, I try to limit the amount of OB that I do. It's a beautiful specialty. You are taking care of two patients, two physiologies. But with that said, there's plenty of comorbidities that can happen. Challenges that I can think of in obstetrics from the anesthesia perspective is one, any emergency C-section, especially if that patient did not have a running epidural to start with. With any emergency C-section, the baby is at risk of a significant comorbidities or demise. So all the teams involved have to be in sync and you would have to act quick and efficient to keep the patient, both patients, safe. So that's one of the biggest thing in OB anesthesia is I feel like is an emergency C-section. Then you can also have an unstable mother and an unstable fetus that can be problematic, or you would have to try to stabilize the mother while the obstetric team, as well as your anesthetic interventions, tries to help the fetus as well. Third, one of the big things about OB anesthesia would be bleeding. Postpartum hemorrhage can be a big issue, and sometimes it can be difficult to control intraoperatively to the point where the patients can go into DIC. So those are huge challenges in OB anesthesia. There are so many other ones that I can think of: airway management, aspiration, failed epidurals, as you mentioned. But as far as a failed epidural and postdural puncture headaches, even though they're frustrating for the clinician and the patient, most more importantly, those are not big challenges in OB anesthesia. If I do have to troubleshoot a failed epidural, the main thing to do is to acknowledge that epidural is not working and to try to replace it as soon as possible. Of course, you would troubleshoot it to see what's working and what's not working. That's for the laboring patient on the floor. As far as intraoperatively, prior to any surgical stimulation, you need to assure that your epidural level is up to surgical standards. If that's not assured, then it's worth the trouble of replacing or redoing the neuraxial technique, or consider general anesthesia for such patient. And with general anesthesia and an OB and obstetrics, you are faced with challenges of airway difficulties because of swollen in the airway tissues, a pulmonary a dynamics or physiology that changes drastically in pregnancy. So you would want to avoid general anesthesia as much as possible. But if it's a confirmed failed epidural during the case, then you would have to convert to general anesthesia. As far as a postdural puncture headache, those are typically managed with conservative measures. Well, first of all, very frustrating for the patient that can't participate into a new event in their life, a very important event, because they have severe headaches. But typically, you would manage with fluids, caffeine, analgesic, and potentially a abdominal binder, and to limit the CSF leak that's causing the headache. Outside of that, if that doesn't work, then the best thing to do would be an epidural blood patch. That's where you would get, in a sterile fashion, the patient's blood through an IV, redo an epidural, and inject that blood into the epidural space. The consensus or the physiology behind that is the blood would have clotting factors to patch the dura, a puncture defect, and that would give immediate relief to the patient. So, long-winded answer, but a lot can go into OB, but beautiful feel for those who like treating or taking care of two physiologies or two patients at once.
Okay, I think we're going to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about how you see technology, automation, the use of AI, specifically generative AI, and how you think they're going to be changing and forming the field of anesthesia in the next 10 to 20 years.
With the talk of AI going into different sectors, different fields, of course, it's an exciting time to learn new things. In anesthesia per se, ever so often I try to do some research to see what's out there as far as how is AI affecting the anesthesia world, and how I can put myself in a position to impact or to use artificial intelligence to provide better care or better anesthetic. For now, I don't have a clear answer. I do believe that the first few things I will see in anesthesia is trying to become more efficient as far as scheduling and turnover times and things like that. That would be the basics. But I'm excited to see what the future holds. I think the new generation of anesthesiologists will try to incorporate that as much as possible, and I'm excited to learn more. Maybe you can at some point, you and your colleagues at some point can teach me about AI and how to incorporate it into my practice.
Perfect segue into the new and next generation of anesthesiologists. This last question is for medical students and residents who are going into anesthesiology or considering anesthesiology. What advice would you give about choosing a subspecialty, work-life balance, and what the future job market is going to look like?
To all the medical students listening that want to go into anesthesia, I one want to congratulate you because anesthesia is a beautiful field, a field that will provide you with great flexibility, a good work-life balance, and a lot of joy to work in this field. You get a chance to meet a lot of people, a lot of patients, but everything to a limited fashion. So at the end of the day, once your clinical day is done, you don't have to worry about much else but to go back and enjoy your family. I think that's one of the things that anesthesia provides that very few specialties do provide as well. The compensation is attractive, competitive. We talked about that in during the first series, even though it's not the most lucrative a specialty, but I think you would be satisfied on a financial level. On a clinical level, when you compare yourself to other specialties, you are doing quite a bit to be satisfied with your work. You are truly making a difference in a patient's life and in a team. In an environment, so it's a very fulfilling specialty. And lastly, when in residency, to pursue a subspecialty, it's gonna be up to your personality, to your passion, and where do you want to go, or where you want your practice to take you. Some centers do require a fellowship training in order to become a staff there, especially the academic centers. If you would want to be in a leadership position, usually speaking, they would want to look for a candidate that has a subspecialty. But from my experience, not pursuing a fellowship, a general anesthesiologist does just fine. There's definitely a lot of skills that you can pick up after the residency or during residency, and technically you don't need certain subspecialties. The ones that I do feel like put you head and shoulder above or tailor your practices a different way would be a cardiac anesthesia. That can be very involved. pediatric anesthesia, since the patient population is drastically different. And pain anesthesia also, chronic pain is a different type of a clinical approaches. And sometimes with pain anesthesia, you don't have to deal with the intraoperative stressors, even though there's some other stressors that you can have running your own pain clinic, doing other procedures. So those are things to think about when going into the field. But I do feel like whoever's listening to this and is interested in anesthesia has already made a good decision. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you for the invite, Cardi, and I wish you the best.
And it's been a pleasure to have you on our podcast today. Well, that's a wrap on episode two. Today, we took a deep dive into the risks and complications of anesthesia, what can go wrong, and more importantly, how anesthesia providers are trained to prevent and handle emergencies. We also looked at where anesthesia is headed in the future, from new drugs to cutting-edge monitoring technology. Hopefully, this episode cleared up some misconceptions around anesthesia safety and gave you a better understanding of what goes on behind the scenes. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you found it valuable.